Campus FM presents a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Celebrating Isabel Bourge, an evening of remembrance in honor of the artist.
Tonight, we come together in remembrance of an unspeakably sad occasion. On September 23rd, in the early hours of the morning, most of us lost our good friend, Isabel Bourge. But our plan, as much as it may be possible, is to turn tonight into a celebration of Isabel's life and work. And for that reason, if we can, as it were, keep control of ourselves during the presentation, we will each be talking about some particular aspect of her life or her work very briefly. So let me just introduce the speakers, and then we'll begin. Our first speaker will be Nicholas DePiro and Mary Lou Capini. They will be followed by Jana Mikhalev-Stofrace. After myself, Madeline Gera will speak. Then comes Vicky Ann Cremona, all people who knew intimately Isabel in various different refractions or manifestations. So I hope you get a glimpse of different kinds of Isabel tonight. The last speaker will be yourselves, the audience. I will be here with the microphone, so please just, if you wish to come forward with your thoughts on Isabel, please just indicate, and I will be roaming with the microphone after the other speakers. We very much look forward to hearing your comments tonight. This event is being recorded by Campus Radio, and in the very near future, it will be broadcast. And if you go to the Campus FM, University Campus FM website, you will find it there and can click on tonight's speakers and onto the audience discussion. So without any further ado, Nicholas DePiro and Mary Lou Capini.
Hello, everybody. My problem here is where to start. Many of you knew Isabel long before I did. She was already in her 30s when I met her for the first time. I was back from 17 years of living abroad. And with the help of my old friend, Dennis Vella, I was, so to speak, doing the rounds. I visited and met a number of artists, including Antoine Camilleri, Esprit Barthé, Gabriel Caruana, Cesar Attard, Madeline Gera, and of course Isabel Bourge. I had seen some of her work at Melitensia Art Gallery in Lille. She had painted two of her smaller and very strong portraits of the proprietor, Peter Apo Bologna, without apparently being in the least bit afraid of him. I am sure he was not flattered by her interpretation. But seeing the pictures now, they are creditable, bizarre perhaps, but deep, discerning, perceptive and intuitive, and even logical to a point of almost absurdity. My admiration was easily aroused. Well, well, yes. I looked around and admired the landscapes all over the gallery, but Peter's portraits, both of them, they stuck in my mind. This is a short message from him to all of us today. I am so sorry not to be with you to pay tribute to Isabel's memory. I had the highest regard and affection for her both as a person and as an artist. She was a true original with a great sense of humor and down-to-earth approach to life, but always dignified and her own person. Her works will keep her always in our minds. I would see many other portraits over the coming years. One astute and cunning old dealer with a gallery in England, a character called, I'm going to pronounce this word, Yisław Bygański, was very knowledgeable with a wide understanding of modern art movements. He kept a house at Madlena. He collected a number of Isabel's portraits and raved about them most convincingly. I was impressed not only by his picture collection, but also by the swinging enthusiasm of his character. I'm tempted to focus on individual portraits, such as the picture of Antoine Camilleri with his long white beard, which I believe is known to most of us. another with the head of an exploding eye. I believe it was Profs or Norbert Attard. And there were more. One more fundamental or far-reaching than the next. Not a long time after, Dennis and I were rummaging around among his collected bits and pieces when I picked up a picture and said, "Stop. Look, Dennis, this must be the best portrait ever painted of you." He agreed. It was by Isabel Borge. He then added, "Have you seen my portrait by Debbie?" When we found it, I said, "She's flattered you." His response was, "Murlem Barun, you need to learn to appreciate good looks." By 2001, I was approaching my 60th birthday. My mother said she would like to commission a portrait of me. I thought about this, and I was much encouraged by the fact that I did not have to pay for it. I marched into Dennis's office at the museum and said, "Dennis, who shall I ask to paint my portrait?" He answered without any hesitation at all, "Isabel, she's here right through you." And so it was Isabel. She painted me on two canvases. A major part of me she put on one canvas and a lesser part on the other. When the canvases touched, I was complete. I had become a diptych. I had previously explained to her that I did not want to influence her except on one score. "Don't paint a picture of me," I said. "Just put me in the picture. Please make it a picture that somebody might be prepared to hang one day as a genre piece. I do not want a passport photograph." Isabel had no problem with this. She understood that what she produced did not please Granny. But as far as I was concerned, in spite of her having painted an unappealing old man, it was a great success. It is much admired by tourists who visit my home. And although the chair I am sitting on seems to be about to topple into Grand Harbor, they say, "That's good. Who's the artist?" Dennis Vella wrote, "Isabel Borge does not select her sitters for their looks alone. They need not be attractive, but are real people of the 20th century with achievements, ambitions, failures, and compromises that an artist of such contemporary sensibility cannot honestly ignore, but has chosen instead to paint with solidarity and commitment. The expressions that are revealed through her sitter's eyes indicate their hard-earned knowledge that the price of survival is raised higher with every passing day, while their lips, which could otherwise say so much, are reticent, as if knowing that the painted result of their encounter with Isabel Borge will convey nuances of emotion that words cannot, leaving her audience perplexed but enriched." Good old Dennis. He understood more. He recognized the depths of a luminous artist. In her own words, Isabel says, "Painting portraits is exhausting. Imagine simultaneously looking at someone's face intently, reconstructing it in paint on canvas, and exchanging gossip, confessions, reminiscences, and heated arguments. It is a good thing that pictures are silent, because a portrait actually says more about the painter than the sitter. Perhaps this is why some of my faces look so miserable. Or is it boredom that gives them that look of wanting to escape from their framed confines?" In one excellent horizontal pinky portrait of Graham, I see none of this. Love and passion does things to us, and especially, I suppose, to creative artists. In this portrait, she clearly delights in what she is doing. As for her suitcases, Dominic Quitayar also got it right. He was clearly impressed by those portraits and refers to, quote, "suppressed drama, surreptitiously kept out of view, maybe even locked in some discarded suitcase tucked away in an attic." He adds, "Isabel Borge has regaled contemporary Maltese art with a completely novel sensation, such as we have not experienced for a very long time. As we approach Isabel's retrospective at the Museum of Fine Arts in 2002, she was confident, windswept, and still very creative. This is some of what I said in my address to a good-sized audience. A retrospective is a great honor for any living artist. The Museum of Fine Arts is telling us that we should have a look at the progress of a particular artist's work. You should not have a retrospective exhibition unless you are an established artist. Isabel Borge is an established artist. The word established is not one that will appeal to her, but, like it or not, she is now recognized and is being time-honored. Her reputation has been secured. It is not only connoisseurs who have noticed her worth, but also the tough and cruel market, the market that carries you from a studio or commercial gallery to the boardroom or the prestige of an art-collecting household. Why do we part with our money? Perhaps it is for need. Many of us, especially in a successful society, need the prestige which goes with apparent success. Isabel's work has intruded upon the propriety of the socially uncertain, those wishing to do things correctly. Isabel's work is not respectful to the mores and fears of those of us who wish to impress our bank manager with our reliability and basic soundness. Her work abounds with insurgence and upheaval. She has something to say about this unfair world of ours. She wants to tell the truth and she wants to inspire us away from the orthodox. She wants us to drink deep and to taste of the ice-cold spring. She wants us to burn a little with a little bit of lust, the kind we see in her great, sensitive, yet earthly, Neolithic-inspired canvas, Lovers in the Bull. For all these things, let us praise the artist. She is on track. We only have to look at her work all around us, the carefully chosen work of the last 18 years, which has been, yes, intellectually selected by the Museum of Fine Arts. Whatever I say today will not really influence Isabel, and perhaps, to get my own back, I shall not say that she knows where she's going. But we certainly cannot hold back this bolting steed. She will see for herself. She will make mistakes. But, most important, she will have her triumphs. The critics will see this, and so praise to the artist. From my point of view, I'm looking for one thing only. I do not care about the subject matter. I'm not concerned with whether the result is dramatic, pretty, decorative, sad, charming, or boring. So what am I looking for? Originality, perhaps? The word almost frightens me. Too many artists have over-invested in originality and produced little more than a path to nowhere. I am looking for something which can be defined in one word, and the word is quality. Do not always trust your instincts unless you have been and read broadly. There are people who can guide the uninitiated, and even these must be chosen carefully, for their opinions often differ and can be controversial. Top dealers are often quickly on the ball. Had you years ago, or better still, had your parents walked down Bond Street, the Via del Babuino, or a dozen other streets in Milan, Paris, New York, and so on, and had you asked, who are the best modern artists working now, you would probably have been able to make a short list of some very real talent. What chance was there for us to recognize the abstract and cubism and a number of valid concepts in the ever-developing mind of the artist? What chance for us to have nice and early spotted Andy Warhol, Fontani, Bernard Buffet, Stanley Spencer, Manzoo, Walter Sickert, John Bradby, Boccioni, Archipenko? The answer is always none at all. There were four artists in Malta in the 20th century whose names strode the century. They were Cali, Kawanadingli, Mangione, and Shortino. Then, of course, there were the others. Some of them noteworthy. There are five or six artists living in Malta now, who, because of their gifts and some integrity, I believe will survive. Mangione alone was the ultimate rebel within a blinkered and stringent society. I am purposely not mentioning Antoine and Esprit, as they came later. When you judge, remember that skill without imagination is craft. Craft is fine, but it is not great art. It is polished technique. Imagination without skill gives us a lot of modern art. It is a little sophistication, imagination, courage, and some understated skill that we are after. But can we find it? Is it really there? Once you start compromising your thoughts, you are a candidate for mediocrity. Isabel Borge has not compromised anything. She is one of my candidates for the century. Listen to this. By 2006, I had felt I could be extravagant, as I said about Isabel. Her exhibition was a new vision dominated by red, both the landscapes and the portraits, the pictures. They supported each other. They looked great together. I remember thinking, these should not be dispersed. I was a fervent admirer when I wrote. Isabel Borge is no ordinary artist. She risks and she tumbles and she breathes deeply and she turns somersaults and she shouts and she cries and she suffers pain and she celebrates euphoria. Her students at the University of Malta are fortunate to share with her the knowledge and the pangs of creativity. She takes what she's got and uses it, and she's got what it takes, and she is strong enough both emotionally and skillfully to carry her resourcefulness, her inspiration and her vision, to and sometimes to victory. That is what I felt about her in 2006, and it is also what I feel about her now. I do not like being sentimental when discussing art, but perhaps we can make an exception today. I have used a medieval format, a sestina, for us to praise her in verse and also to remember with her the person who, as long as he lived, always encouraged her. Mary Coppini has kindly agreed to read Sestina for two friends.
I feel I ought to burst into song. Right. Sestina for two friends. Let us all try to smile this Christmas day. The effort may seem hard, but on we go. And life proceeds. But we shall not forget our love of Dennis and of Isabel. How short a time for friendship, then no more. And we are here, and they are gone away. Yes, love lives on since they are gone away, and we shall think of them on Christmas Day. Perhaps a toast this year and then some more. Their memory might fade, but must not go. God bless you both, Dennis and Isabel. You're with us still, and we shall not forget. Do you, where you are now, think we'll forget? Because you've left us here and gone away? No, Dennis, you are dear, and Isabel. If you do think of us on Christmas Day, we think of you and how you had to go, and wish so much that we could meet once more. There's music where you are, and there is more. We hear it still, and we do not forget. And do the artists there all come and go to paint the skies that each day go away? And do you have a glorious Christmas Day? Oh, do you, Dennis? Do you, Isabel? Your pictures shed your light, dear Isabel. They celebrate your life in time and more. And Dennis, what you wrote lives on today. You've left a gap that we cannot forget. If both of you are far, far, far away, you've left behind you things that did not go. Should we remember you or let you go? Some time can heal. Yes, Dennis, Isabel. But no, the pang, it must not go away. For what you were was good. We love you more, and love is need, and we must not forget to think of you this year on Christmas Day. Away. Farewell, but not forevermore. Go, Isabel and Dennis. Don't forget, we too shall go to you one Christmas Day.
being extremely low-tech, I don't have PowerPoints or pictures or anything. In the early 90s were quite an interesting, stroke exciting time for what I would broadly call equality issues here in Malta. In fact, in 93 or time of around that time, we actually got an amendment to family law, which brought around a revolution in the status of especially married women in this country. Yes, I'm a lawyer, in case you don't know me, Divri. And yes, it does have something to do with Isabel. It has a lot to do with Isabel. Maybe some, and Isabel not immediately you think about. Because at that time, 20 years ago, you know, I was a lot younger, you know, a lot of ideals. I was involved in a few women's issues and movements and stuff. I was specifically involved in the National Council of Women, who were, and still are, I suppose, I'm not involved now, but they're more what I call the mainstream, you know, let's change the legislation, let's speak to the right people. And they approached change in that valid way. Isabel had just returned from the UK, and being the person she was, she saw certain things which she didn't like. And being the person she was, she decided to do something about it instead of just complain. So she set about organizing a pressure group, as opposed to what I would call a more traditional kind of women's movement. She wanted a pressure group to try and get an issue, a specific issue across. And I was borrowed from National Council of Women, and a lot of similarly minded women were borrowed or stolen. I was actually stolen eventually, but anyway. And we would meet in Isabel's living room and would discuss what are we going to do, what can we do, what shall we call ourselves, should we have a statute, shouldn't we have a statute. Eventually we had a statute, but it was kind of, you know, something you needed to do. It's not that it was even that important for us, you know. We called ourselves Movement Mara Maltia. It sounded really good, yeah. Isabel was the president. We used to have a really good time. We were there, obviously, because we wanted to do stuff, but it was, you know, we used to have a really good time, you know, with Isabel and so on. And basically, what did Movement Mara Maltia do? Something perhaps not very many people know. Movement Mara Maltia, when we looked around and said, what can we do specifically? We wanted to do something practical, useful, and could relatively quickly be done, which are not very easy goals. So we asked around, we asked, you know, women who are in need, or people in need in general, politicians, and obviously Isabel had her own way of dealing with politicians. You weren't around then, Mario. She wasn't there with you too. Obviously, there is a way to deal with politicians, and there's Isabel's way. There's a way to deal with the usually, you know, where you go up to them, oh, hello, what are you going to do about it? Why haven't you done this? Don't you know we need it? And people go around really shocked. I mean, those of us who knew Isabel, we're not shocked, I mean, you know. But for Malta, at least, it was a very fresh approach, for want of a better way of putting it. Anyway, after all these seminars, meetings, this and that, we decided that there needed to be a helpline. Because although now there's a helpline, the 179, which is now organized by a POCH, at the early 90s, this did not exist. And being someone who works in family court, there was a dire need. For nothing else, the moral support and the practical help that people needed, because you wouldn't know where to go. And if you are a person who is a victim, for want of a better term, you're not even in the state of mind to look for help, you know. You just need something quick, easy. And basically, yes, Movement Mara Maltia Actually, we didn't obviously physically set it up because we didn't have the funds to do, but it was Movement Mara Maltija who went ahead with the idea. It was picked up and, well, it's still there. And in fact, the first few people who were manning the phones, etc., in the beginning, a lot of them were Movement Mara Maltija people or persons who were searched or picked out by Movement Mara Maltija. Now, Isabel, then, I mean, basically, when that was set up, we kind of felt, look, this is what we set up to do. There are other people who are there on a more long-term basis. We're happy with what we've done. And Movement Mara Maltija stopped over there. But Isabel didn't. As we know, Isabel then went on to environmental issues and things of the sort. As I said, I was stolen from National Council of Women, but I was willingly stolen. And through this meeting, eventually Isabel was one of my closest friends, someone whose support I always had, and who had mine, obviously. And we continued to have really good times in her living room, basically. Thank you.
On 20th December 2002, the curator of the National Museum of Fine Arts, the late Dennis Vella, opened the exhibition of a marvelous retrospective of Isabel's work, Isabel Borge, Paintings of the Last 18 Years. Nicholas DePiro has explained what an impact that exhibition had on those who attended. That exhibit illustrated beautifully the wide variety of Isabel's work in relation to both style and theme. Figurative paintings, portraits, landscapes, abstracts, what I like to call her cityscapes, and her art of the body. I would like to begin very, very briefly by pointing to some of the diversity in Isabel's art. I begin with a painting known very, very well to Maltese audiences, but I'll just spend a moment talking about it because tonight's event is being recorded and will be broadcast live, specifically because some of her friends have written from far away, from England or from Australia, to say that they would like to hear what is being said tonight. This famous, perhaps her most famous painting, Lovers in the Bull, it is often forgotten that this was actually the graduation work of a young artist. This incredibly bravura performance is the work of a newly graduating artist. It is on a very, very big canvas. A dear friend of mine who is a great collector of art once said of her work that it takes talent to fill a large canvas. A large canvas is one of the distinguishing marks between a very fine artist and one who is perhaps not so fine. Well, this is a very large canvas indeed. One notices not merely the erotic theme, but also the wide variety of shape and color. One notices the way the extraordinary combination of forms and colors come together with an exuberance which manages to be both intimate and also to establish what for some people has become an icon of Maltese art, because this bull, as many of you know, is taken from the reliefs, the stone reliefs, on the temple at Tarshen. Here we have some of her abstract work, just very, very briefly in passing. One of the features of her abstract work is, in fact, the elegance of line, the deft simplicity. There's a certain minimalism, but at the same time, there's this extraordinary elegance. Now I want briefly to show you just a few of what I call her cityscapes. This is a genre which Isabel developed, which in fact focuses on the Grand Harbor and shipping in Grand Harbor. This painting of shipping in Grand Harbor makes use of her technique of matting, which she put on the canvas and then she painted over it, which gives a certain very real body to her paintings and a definite focus in the middle of her paintings. This is one of my favorite works by Isabel. It shows her use of line and monochromatic colors to capture modern contemporary shipping in Grand Harbor. Once again, I point to the sheer elegance of the work, its deft use of color, its willingness to be brief in its statements, and at the same time, what a full picture it is. And here I want to end this extremely brief coverage of her diversity by pointing to a large canvas of hers, which is the garden. Florentine Gardens is the title of the picture. It's a picture of very formal gardens and maze in Florence. This picture conjures up the incredible sense of architecture or structure in her paintings, which I think many of us have experienced. And I would add that her mazes, and there are people here who have her mazes and her formal garden paintings, have a certain air of mystery about them. But I think that mystery is only conveyed because the powerful structure is there. And this use of color, once again, the word deft comes to mind. It seems very complete, very apposite. It's neither underdone nor overdone. But above all else, the architecture of living things comes through this painting. Now I want to turn briefly to a second aspect of her work, her art of the body. Again, I want to argue that in the few pictures I'm going to show you, there is a terrific elegance of color and of line. This is her famous portrait of I presume professional girls waiting at Albertown to be picked up. It's one of my favorite pictures of Isabel because, like so much of her art of the body, it has this in-your-face sensuality about it. And here is a painting of hers which manages to combine an elegance of line for the human figures and an elegance of color for the background painting of building and sea. I think it's a beautifully balanced and pointed composition, semi-abstract. Isabel liked to work both. She liked to combine the abstract with the representational in various combinations in her work. And I think it's one of her most elegant works, precisely because the balance of color and naked human body is so beautifully balanced. And finally, a rendition of a male figure in the alcove in her studio. Once again, deft, brief, not quite minimalist, but somehow it beautifully expresses the attitude of the young man being portrayed in this portrait, but also, of course, the grace of his form. And one seems to see in this a kind of union between the alcove in the background and the young man standing there being depicted by Isabel. As I keep on saying over and over again, elegance of color and line. Finally, I would like to, before I go on to a final comment on her art, I would like to mention that Isabel and I jointly wrote the chapter on Maltese Art of the Body for the volume edited by Dennis Vella in 2008 entitled Cross Currents. Raphael Vella's volume investigated the social origins and social consequences of contemporary Maltese art and architecture. In our own chapter on the art of the body, Isabel and I, after discussing many different artists and their images, reached the conclusion that overall, Maltese art of the body is dominated by what we call textuality. And by textuality, we meant that Maltese art of the body tends to refer elsewhere, to use the body as a symbol for social or political or religious or psychological themes. I personally doubt whether that can be said of Isabel's own paintings of the body. I would rather argue that her own body art tends to be a very direct celebration of the forms and attractions of human bodies. And lastly, let me turn briefly to the Irish landscapes that she created in the last 10 years of her life. These have been exhibited. Some shown in a collaborative exhibition with her partner, the photographer Graham Cooper. What I would like to emphasize once again in looking at her Irish landscapes is the powerful sense of architecture in these paintings. Let me just take you through a few of them. And here is Isabel in Ireland, photographed by Dennis, by Graham, as she was painting and sketching. And in fact, the picture she was sketching, I'll now show you. That photograph shows you her sketching this scene, which she then rendered in paint. The point is, as her students know, she was a very, very strong believer in the necessity of constant drawing and constant life drawing as well. And here we have her in Ireland at the top of one of those landscapes which she overviewed so beautifully, inspecting the drawing which she has just done. She used to sometimes paint from life, but very often based upon many, many sketches taken live out of doors. She would then go back to Graham's house in Clonakilty, near Cork in Ireland, and then from her imagination, she would compose and recompose the various sketches in this unified work of art which you see. And of course, what we can obviously see here is that she's moving from, again, I always like to say, very structured sketches, but sketches which are very realistic, to something which is much more a product of the imagination. This is a painting of a bay in southeastern Ireland. Graham, is this Bantry Bay? Pardon? I see. A different set of colors here, a different kind of color harmony, but once again, powerful sense of structure. Here, this painting is of a view which she sketched from high up on a hill. So what you're looking down on is a small lake, and below, even again, you see the sea and the bay and the mountains in the distance. And she's, as it were, collapsed all of this into the four corners of the painting to create, in what I suppose is the best modernist fashion, a piece of art which is be valid within the four sides and corners of the painting. Here we have, in a different set of colors, what I like to call russets and matted colors, which were often a favorite of hers. Here we have some strata, some geological strata, which through the centuries have become upended. So you're actually looking at a set of horizontal geological strata with the sea and the bay behind. And in contrast to some of the previous paintings, where the sky was very, very dark and brooding, here we have a very, very light sky. And here, the last painting I'll illustrate tonight, you have one of her marvelous big canvases. And here, I think what we see very well is that in her Irish landscapes, she opened up to a very wide dimension of space. Her Irish landscapes are not afraid of immensity. Indeed, they encompass and celebrate immensity. So I'll leave you with a final thought. It's not been at all difficult to talk about her. I could talk on and on and on. And I will simply say that her art celebrates the architecture of nature, including the architecture of the human body and the architecture of human industry. And in so doing, it always exhibits this elegance of line and this exuberance of color.
Right. Okay. I'm Madeleine Gerard, for those of you who don't know me. And Isabel Bourge was, more than anything, one of my, probably my oldest friend. And it seemed a bit strange for me to have to sort of read, you know, about her tonight, knowing, you know, being somebody I know so well. Isabel was one of Malta's foremost artists, and her work is vibrant, bold. She was never formulaic, and in some respects, her paintings were a visual diary of her life. We became friends in our mid-teens, and I remember it started at painting lessons in Victor Diakono's studio in Slema. And I distinctly remember making a watercolor portrait sketch with Isabel of one of Victor's sons in our class. Our friendship sadly came to a close within an artistic context too. I had done a number of sketches of Isabel during her last days, and practically till the very end, I would bring my digital camera to her bedside and keep her updated about what I was up to in my studio. Isabel had been a regular at my Saturday life class, right up until the telephone call when she told me she wouldn't be returning back to her job at the university. I knew what she meant, and as Lucian Freud once said, if creativity comes as a series of shocks, that call from Isabel was one of them. This evening, I wish to talk about Isabel's portraits. When she came back from London after completing her degree at Camberwell School of Art, she embarked on a series of portraits. These were strong expressionistic images of her friends, acquaintances, and colleagues. There were more observed portraits of her parents, Aldo and Renato Borge, and also one of anyone who caught her eye and agreed to sit for her. To my mind, these are the first in a series of Isabel's friendship portraits, as they seem to be painted as a way for her to reconnect with people after her time away in the United Kingdom, or as a way of making new friends with those sitting for her. These sessions in her Floriano studio were often followed by lunch or coffees and discussion. And for those of you who know Isabel, Izzy loved to discuss, as Jana said here. Eventually, an exhibition of her portraits followed at the Museum of Archaeology, her rogues gallery, as she humorously referred to some of the characters in her collection. She was very much into Fayum portraits at the time, and I recall her enthusiasm for these Egyptian mummy portraits painted on wood panel, these identity paintings intended for the afterlife, which so fascinated her at the time. That initial cycle of portraits bore more than a glancing likeness to Fayum. Some of her subjects here and sitters were the following: Paul Sankasia, Norbert Attard, Francis Abeya, friends from Camberwell, Antoine Camilleri, and several others. I had modeled for Isabel twice during this period, and she painted me with flaming red hair in one portrait and wearing a mask in the next, an image which comprises one third of a triptych, along with the portrait of Julian Manduka and Isabel's self-portrait. The triptych is now in a private collection in the UK. Next came her figures and portraits in a spatial context. I remember, you know, in our conversations at the time, Izzy was talking a lot about Giotto and Masaccio and their creation of figures in a spatial context. I recall the thrill of going to her studio in Floriana and seeing large canvases in various stages of construction. I remember her use of ochre and cadmium red figures, and one specifically of her friend, Eva von Fersen-Balsan, in a large industrial setting, the one that Paul referred to as the two working ladies. This portrait always, then there was a portrait of Catherine Eisenberg-Vassallo sitting in an alcove in Izzy's studio. And this portrait always struck me as having a very peaceful and thoughtful feel to it. Next came a fairly large piece of a crouching male figure on a bastion in Valletta, and another of a man, another of two men in heated debate. She used fiery blues, warm cadmium reds, Naples yellow, and soft magenta hues, and the swish, swish, swish of Izzy's brush. I remember Izzy used all sorts of material to paint with, all sorts of brushes, and she was very inventive and unorthodox in the kind of brushes she used, and wasn't afraid of, you know, improvising, using industrial brushes, large, big things like this, you know, for her canvases. I remember her also telling me, figurative painting is subversive, so keep doing it. And she kept saying this over and again. And Isabel had a way with words, and for those of you who know her, a great sense of humor. She could also be very irreverent one minute, and then surprisingly orthodox the next, and I often wondered why. Later in 2002, when she and her partner, Graham Cooper, were living in Ireland, she started another series of what I call friendship portraits over there. And then when she came back to Malta in 2008, I recall a superb suitcase portrait of Lisa Gwen Baldacchino. Sometime in the future, I do intend to give a talk at the Museum of Fine Arts about Isabel's portraits. It will deal with a number of aspects of her work and attempt to look at questions we often discussed. One of these was, what sort of painter do you want to be? And this may sound like an existential question. However, I firmly believe that every painter consciously or maybe unconsciously asks these questions about their work. Otherwise, painting can be meaningless. To my mind, the answer has a lot to do with the education an artist receives, whether formally or as an apprentice. It also has a great deal to do with the artist's own sources and likes. I personally have a database of artists whose work I admire and which I spend a lot of time looking at, and I know Isabel did the same thing too. For instance, her first series of portraits were done at a time when she was very much engaged by Fayum portraits. She also loved Max Beckmann, and I believe we can see this in her self-portrait in a blue dressing gown. This does not for one minute mean that her work was derivative, on the contrary. Isabel's painting was very familiar to me, and vice versa. But we painted very differently. We had different concerns, a different palette, and we certainly treated our brushes differently. I think it also has a lot to do with training, and it also has a lot to do with temperament as well. Isabel's work has its roots firmly in modernism. I shall stop here and end with this anecdote. When Izzy was still at Camberwell School of Art, she took an interest in Titian's later work. Towards the end of his life, Titian's brushstrokes became very loose and almost impressionist. Well, Izzy took a liking to Titian's playing of Marsyas, one of his grimmest paintings, but not without a certain gallows humor to it. For those of you who know the canvas, there is a little doggy cheekily lapping up blood, and a figure on the right side obliviously playing a violin, while poor Marsyas, suspended upside down, a resigned expression on his face, is being skinned alive as a punishment for his precociousness. A mafioso murder, if you ask me. But Isabel painted her own version of Marsyas, and I remember having a look at the painting while she told me. I got the model to hang upside down from an open door while I painted him. Shrieks of laughter followed. Dear Izzy, we will all miss you.
I'm not qualified to talk about art, but I would like to talk about a person I knew. Her name was Isabel Bourge, and she was my closest friend in Malta. And I would like to tell a story about her, and it's a story about a pair of shoes. The objects of Isabel we have here are objects of her studio and Isabel's big boots. I'd like to talk about the Isabel who could walk with these heels and not fall flat on her face. I'd like also to talk about the Isabel who bought one of the most glamorous dresses I've ever seen to go with this, which was black. It had a black bodice and a black velvet bodice and a black sort of silk flimsy bottom, and she wore it for an opening of Patrimonio Malti, which I was involved in dealing with costume. Anyway, these shoes were bought together in London. Isabel was in London doing research on martyrdom and ecstasy, and I was in London basically visiting Isabel, and we went together to buy. Isabel one morning decided she was not going to take me to any libraries like I always wanted to go to, and she said, no, we are going to buy shoes. And I said, okay, but what shoes are we going to buy? And she said, oh no, we're going to go and buy glamorous shoes. So off we went, and went to a place called Johnny Moke in somewhere, I don't know exactly where. And this was a very famous shoe shop, it seems. So I can't wear heels, you know, I can't wear heels, so I always wear low heels. And I was looking at flat shoes, and I really got turned off by saying, you must know how to walk tall and high, and look at the kind of shoes you should wear. And basically, she picked out these shoes, the shoes I'm standing next to, and paraded all across the shop in these high heels, walking as though she was a model or something, and having, all this was interspersed with a lot of giggles. We had met completely by accident another Maltese on the road, Albert Storace, dragged him with us and made him sit down and watch us parade. After which we went to a Chinese restaurant to celebrate the buying of our shoes. But apart from shoes, I will always remember that particular period, because the time I spent with Isabel was a time of great discovery. I discovered the Warburg Institute, thanks to her, and we went together to the National Portrait Gallery, and she would look at portraits and show me what to look at, and also show me what the difference is between a classic pose and how you can break the rules of a classic pose. And the one thing that I admired about Isabel was the fact that she knew exactly what the rules of art were, which means she knew exactly how to break them. And perhaps that is also one of the things that makes her art so vibrant. Isabel had many friends. We're many friends of Isabel's. I think a lot of us are here. And I would like to shift over a little bit from England and move to the first time I ever met Isabel. First time I ever met Isabel was thanks to a university student initiative, which was called the AOK, which was the Arts on Campus, and it was an extremely good initiative where people were invited to talk about art. And Isabel was there talking about female surrealist painters. I had just arrived in Malta, I had no clue as to who this Isabel Borge was, but I like the surrealists very much, and I didn't quite know much about the female surrealist painters, having studied mostly about male surrealist painters at university. So I trooped off to this lecture, and I found this very short cropped haired person wearing a red leather jacket and boots and the black jeans, talking about female surrealist painters and introducing us to people like Lolita Limpica and this sort of thing, with a very strong political message underneath, which was, I felt all through, rebellion and not and unacceptance and defiance and not going along with the stream. And this person really amazed me by the way she bore herself, amazed me by the way she lectured, and amazed me by what she said. And at the end of the lecture, I went to speak to her and I said, you know, listen, you really interested me. I really thought that was a riveting lecture. And she was very surprised that I had enjoyed it so much. And we ended up having a coffee. And then from a coffee, that went to a dinner. And from a dinner, I took her home. And we sat in her, on her sofa for about, I don't know how many hours. I think I forgot how many. And from there developed a very close and intimate friendship. Jana talked about Isabel's sitting room. Isabel's sitting room was a very particular sitting room. It was made of green, it is still actually, made of green sofas with wool, sheepskin over them for in winter. And you kind of were supposed to snuggle against the sheepskin. And then you had all this color, this riot of color of paintings around you. And you were normally given a cup of tea, I mean, definitely tea in my case, because I hate coffee, but a cup of warm tea, and you sat there, and there was a heater, and always very good music in the background, and you snuggled and chatted and argued and fought and made peace and all sorts of things in the at the same time. One thing I always liked about Isabel's art were also her autoportraits. And I think there's a whole chapter if one day one had to think in terms of something to write about Isabel, about her autoportraits and her feelings and the moments they were painted. Because the people who knew the intimate moment she was living could really understand what was behind the portrait and the feelings that emanated from it, and the colors that were used during those, the painting of those autoportraits shed a lot of light about the spirit and the moments they were painted in. She also had, how should I put it? She had a lot of fun moments. I mean, one other anecdote I'd like to talk about is our love for football and the fact that we both come from an Italian background. Her mother was Italian, and my mother comes from Italian parents, and we both spoke Italian. And we obviously were keen supporters of Italy. So I remember going to watch a football game, the final football game of Italy at friends of ours, Lily and Paul, and Italy having actually won the World Cup. And we decided we needed to celebrate. So I had an old Anglia, which was about 27 years old at the time, and which Isabel had baptized Maisie. And Isabel had a flag this big. And we went off to celebrate Italy having won the World Cup. Now, obviously, my car was old, so the horn burnt out immediately. And there were men next to us, had this huge flag, and they were telling us, is that your flag? And we were saying, yes, but it's a flag, isn't it? And then when we couldn't hoot anymore, Isabel said, don't worry, we're going to shout and it's just as good. So we screamed to the top of our voices and we sang all the Italian songs we knew, the songs of the Partigiani, you know, etc. And we made such a row between the two of us that we had, that I think we actually, you know, created more movement and color than all these men waving flags put together. I think, I'm sorry to give like these little pictures, but they are the pictures that come to me when I remember Isabel. There are also other pictures which come to me, which are Isabel running in the countryside and walking very, very fast. She loved nature. She loved walking. She was very energetic. I remember also Isabel in less happy occasions, Isabel in bed, Isabel not quite as energetic as we would have wished her to be, Isabel, you know, trying to find her breath and in spite of it, finding the time to be ironic, to pass some sardonic comment which would, you know, still they have still been making you laugh. And I'd like to finish with, and also I think I'd like to pay a tribute particularly to two things. Thanks to Isabel, my parents and her parents got to be very, very friendly, and they had a very good relationship apart from the relationship that Isabel and I had. I think I'd like to recall the fact that Isabel was always very loyal to her friends, and you could always depend on her. And I'd like to think that she felt that among her friends she could also depend on us. And the last thing I would like to remember is Isabel's joy. And even in the last moments, which was very tenderly taken care of by Graham, who I would like to pay tribute to because he was totally dedicated to Isabel and really gave her a lot of time and love. But I'd like to finish with one happy note. Isabel was a fiery, temperamental sometimes, at times very irritating and hard-headed person who, when she got into an argument, would never get out of it. But she was, most of all, I call, a bundle of fun. And the one thing I want to remember about her is this fun and humor and irony she would bring along with her. And one of the lovely memories I have of Isabel is in her last moments, she was singing and singing very happily. And I think she carried that song with her beyond, and I can still hear it today. And I think we would all like to sing with her tonight while recalling her. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Vicky. Well, now it's the turn of the audience. If there are any of you who wish to say something or remember something, please just let me know.
Just a comment as a former student of Isabel's, as a history of art undergraduate. She was one of the very few lecturers we had who didn't compromise either in her standards with her students. She went so far as to help us with our writing skills to an extent that I think very, very few lecturers do. Isabel also followed a very serious academic career. Again, with the same standards that she had with her art. She, I believe, gave us a credit on ex voto paintings, didn't she? She had also written about it. And that was the one opportunity that we had. It was an optional, I think, series of lectures, that we had to follow this incredibly curious and engaging mind of hers. I think she had also tried to take her academic career further. She was actually accepted by the Courtauld Institute, no less, to pursue her PhD studies. But I'm under the impression that somehow she wasn't able to keep that up and pursue her artistic work as seriously as she wished to. I'd like to think that the loss for art historians was the gain for tomorrow's artists, because I do know students who then followed her classes together with Cesar Attard and who have gone on to become very accomplished in their own right.
It's very hard to say anything about a colleague and friend with whom for 14 years I used to meet every day, bar Saturdays and Sundays, and occasionally that too, in circumstances that require dedication and concentration. And of course, in an environment which is demanding, because nothing is perfect here in Malta. And Isabel, when she came to, when Junior College was established and she joined us, because I was there as a sixth form teacher before that. So she joined me, and we had the department between us. And my first request was that we follow a kind of collaborative teaching of all the students by means of a kind of roster. That is, she teaches my students and I teach hers, and therefore it was a kind of open system whereby I would know what she is doing, she knows what I'm doing, and therefore it requires a lot of understanding and cooperation. And I wasn't surprised, actually, because I knew her before then, that she said yes immediately, and that shows her intellectual alertness and frankness in her approach to teaching, to education, and also to collaborating with her colleagues. My experience in the junior college was, my experience of her was extraordinary. I had difficult colleagues before. I wouldn't say she's an easy colleague to work with, but that's leaving out many, many other aspects of her character, and much of these have been already exposed here. But this was really indicative of the type of person she was. That is, she imagine you're working with your own students, and she comes in and she continues to, engages herself with what you are doing and allows you to do the same with hers, you know, without any qualms, without any reservation. And of course, she was more than a colleague, because we used to go out and have, you know, continue our discussions elsewhere through the busy bee and in the breaks and back again and in the office. It was an unforgettable experience for me working with her. I think she was the only colleague I had about whom I can say I was really working with someone closely and collaboratively. Of course, so this is an aspect of her personality and her character, her strong character, is her generosity. And that is her relationship with her students, which not everyone understood at first. There were times when she was misunderstood, because she demanded a lot of the students, and therefore she wouldn't take half measures or fooling around. But later on, many of these changed their mind about her, even during the first year or the second year, and appreciated what she was doing with them. Another aspect of her, something that struck me as well, let me see, because I think, apart from her generosity, she was also she was assertive, especially with regards to the other colleagues. And this was something also which I want to point out, because although it's very tempting for us to say a lot of nice things, you know, steering away from the difficulties that face us in life, face everybody, and her also, she was respectful towards others, and this respect showed not in a sentimental or in a kind of as a result of timidity or shyness, but out of conviction. But she demanded respectfulness as well, because she respected herself, and therefore in her approach, or rather in her relationship with others, with other colleagues of the administration and so on, she wouldn't accept the certain ways of dealing with her in particular, or with women in particular, and this was pointed out by Liana in particular, and I can corroborate in a few what she had said. Her defiance actually was a standing ground for what she stood for, and not budging her principles and allowing others to you know, take a ride. Anyway, I think I said more than enough. Thank you.
Well, I am one of those friends of whom Isabel made a portrait. Actually, what I want to do in this brief intervention is really express four wishes. This portrait, which was shown in the exhibition at the Archaeology Museum, is one which I like very much, because I think she managed to bring out the sort of clown aspect in me, which survives despite the attempts to suppress it that my life has consisted of. It is mostly green. When the university wanted to put up a portrait of me among the rectors of the university, I presented this portrait to the university, but it was rejected. The rector of the time and everybody seemed to agree with him refused to put it up. So I withdrew it, but since then, of course, they have had a more orthodox portrait done, and I wanted Madeleine Gera to do it. However, I would very much like this portrait to be displayed, and I think the most appropriate place is the theater of the junior college, which was named after me, and where I think this portrait would fit in very well. I'm saying this because I would like it to be rescued from the oblivion, the dungeon, or wherever it is lying in the university at present. The second remark which I want to make is following up what Teresa Vella said. There is an aspect of Isabel which hasn't been highlighted, which is precisely her academic interest in art, or I would almost say her philosophic interest in art. She wrote, for instance, what I think is one of the most interesting essays on Victor Passmore. Actually, in this essay, she tried to bring out correspondences between Passmore's abstract work in Malta and Maltese megalithic art. And when Passmore first read this, he rejected it completely. But towards the end of his life, when he was talking to me, I was surprised that he himself was telling me that without his knowing it, he had in fact expressed exactly what Isabel had described in his work. So I would be very pleased if her writings, such as this essay on Passmore, which I think has never been published, were brought out and in fact published. So that's my second wish. The third thing I want to say about her is that I had picked her quite arbitrarily, using to the maximum extent my rector's prerogatives, and appointed her to give an art course at the university which would be open to all students. I mean, this was my attempt at doing something like the degree plus courses now, except that you could actually get credit for it. And in order to enable Isabel to do this, I actually had a space which was one of the few unused spaces which I could find in the university, which was the old gun site, which is now part of the architecture building. And I had that fully equipped for it to function as an art studio, as the sort of class which Isabel wanted to hold, where she wanted also to hold live nude painting and so on. Unfortunately, I mean, she did hold these courses for some time, but she didn't have this studio space for it, or workplace. Unfortunately, the space was, as soon as I lost control, appropriated by the architectural faculty and turned into a laboratory where they make architectural models. And in fact, Isabel did not continue giving these classes at the university. I would very much like to see this restored, reestablished, and that a place, possibly this place where Isabel worked, to be called after her, so that the contribution which she made, which Teresa Vella has recalled, should be remembered here. But basically, those are the three wishes which I wanted to express. The fourth, which I was alluding to, was that she was, for a long time, a regular participant in the philosophy club. She turned up every time and made inputs. But there, I think, something happened which was a bit alluded to by Caesar at Tarte. I think she felt that her contributions weren't taken seriously. Teresa also mentioned the fact that she had stopped her PhD studies, and the reason she gave for it was the one which Teresa quoted, namely that she said she felt that doing seriously her pursuing seriously her academic studies at PhD level was incompatible with her continuing to do her work as an artist. But I don't think that was the only cause. The subject she was working on, Vicky Ann alluded, martyrdom and ecstasy, was essentially the iconography of Saint, Sebastian, of Saint Sebastian. And as you probably know, many of the paintings of Saint Sebastian have been interpreted as homosexual. And Isabel was pursuing this line. I mean, she was martyrdom and ecstasy. I would say martyrdom, ecstasy, and sexuality was the subject which she was exploring through this iconographical history of Saint Sebastian. And I think she was having problems with getting the sort of thing which she was doing accepted. I remember very often her interventions were of this kind. For instance, when the Caravaggio symposium with some of the world's leading Caravaggio scholars was held at the President's Palace in the Caravaggio anniversary year, she raised the question of Caravaggio's alleged homosexuality. And she was almost poo-pooed by the academic scholars present there. And she used to be very hurt when there was that kind of response to her very serious and thought-out provocations, let us say. And I think that also affected her. But I have no wish to express about this, except perhaps to supplement what I said about publishing her essays by suggesting that the work which she had done, and she had done a lot of work on this kind of subject, should somehow be resuscitated.
Thank you very much, Teresa Vella and Father Peter, for highlighting Isabel's academic engagement. I'm sure there are people here who will remember how strongly she used to speak in favor of Victor Passmore and his work.
I'd just like to add something small to Father Peter's wish list. I know I've already written about it, and maybe people are fed up of hearing me say it, but Isabel's work needs to have a new retrospective. Her last retrospective was in 2002. I mean, it's 2010. Now some of her works are still in her home. Some of the works in private collections have never been seen by people my age, by her students. I think she needs to be remembered properly. I think a serious publication needs to be done to accompany this, so that we can really remember Isabel, because she is one of the foremost, and I will stress it, female painters in Malta. We do not have a lot of female artists to begin with, and when it comes to painting, she was one of the tops. So we can't just let her, you know, her pass by and just go unnoticed. You know, we need to mark her presence over here with something serious and something which will, for which will be remembered for a long, long time, even in libraries and whatnot. That's it.
I got to know Isabel a very long time ago, when a girlfriend of mine was actually taking classes at with her, and I used to go to this to fetch my girlfriend and go there about 15, 20 minutes earlier because I was interested in what Isabel had to say. And after that, we became friends somehow. And this was years and years and years ago. And unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know what to say, how to say this, but the last time I saw Isabel was at hospital. We were both there for different reasons. And we got the nurses and the doctors completely crazy because we used to be moving across from one room to the other. When I could escape, I would go to her room, and we used to discuss. And even though she couldn't actually breathe, she would still be able to make me laugh. And if we are actually laughing, she's going, "I'd have to stop this because I can't actually laugh," and because she couldn't actually, you know, breathe and laugh at the same time. And we were always. We used to meet at the jazz festival, and Graham and I are both bikers, and so we had that connection. And the one thing that I've noticed here, and I'm very happy that you actually mentioned that there was a person besides the artist. I didn't really know her that well as an artist, but I knew her as a person, and she was fun, she was ironic, she was very strong-willed, and she used to kick people in the butt, basically, to do what they actually really wanted to do. She coaxed me into pursuing my PhD. She coaxed me into teaching visual anthropology. She, you know, used to discuss a lot of things with me. When I was scared, she used to go, "You don't have to be. Just go out there and do it." And that was how her life was, and that was how she, you know. She needs to be remembered, I think. The fun, loving, beautiful, beautiful person that she was. So that's basically my contribution.
Thank you very much, Stephen. So thank you very much from the speakers to the audience for your very, very interesting comments and additions. And finally, a big thanks to Graham Cooper for having helped Madeline, Jera, and myself with our PowerPoint presentations of Isabel's art and photographs of Isabel tonight. Thanks, Graham.
You have just listened to a talk in the Work in Progress seminar series entitled Celebrating Isabel Borge, an evening of remembrance in honor of the artist who died at the age of 51.